Welcome to Listen to Older Voices, a program produced for Uniting Melba and podcast through the Toorak Times. It's always a pleasure to bring you, through their stories, the life and times of older people in our community. All very interesting, all very different, and all very entertaining. This is a special Baby Boomers edition. Hello, Rob Greaves here, and it's a pleasure to bring you the second and final part of the life and times story of Kathleen Holton. Last week we learned that Kath developed a social and political conscience through her father. She became a teacher of primary school children, but she also had itchy feet, which manifested itself in extensive travels throughout parts of Asia, the subcontinent, the Middle East, and Europe. This week, we conclude the story of her overseas trip and learn how she fell ill in India toward the conclusion of that trip and how she returned to Australia. She shares how she meets Peter, who she had an instant attraction to and whom she settled down with for the rest of her life. They find a piece of land in Chum Creek in the Yarra Valley where they build a beautiful mud brick home. It turns out to be quite a learning experience for Kath and for some time quite a challenge. No sewage or even a septic tank, no electricity and a generator that only ran at night with a limited number of things that could be plugged into it. Add a kerosene fridge and a wood stove, life was pretty basic. It's at this time of her working life that changes take place. The first is taking up a job as a teacher for 10 years with kids with behavioural and learning issues, which was both rewarding and a challenge. Then, when the funding for that position ran out, she made the transition to working with older people as the coordinator of a community support organisation located in Hillsville. Recently retired, she now finds time to do the things that she's always wanted to do, including painting, photography, reading, and working as a volunteer. Kath finishes up sharing some of her philosophies and beliefs, particularly her positive regard for the young people of the day. In fact, it's her belief that the future is rosy and the kids of today will take good care of it. We pick up with Kath talking about how they were saved from the bus crash in Pakistan. So you're in a desert and a bus that smashed. How do you get out of that?
Well, then after a couple of hours, a convoy of like utes and little trucks and things came along and we all piled onto them and were driven into Kandahar or something like that.
So it was part of the adventure in some ways.
No one got hurt. Well, one man was injured, but we just drove away from that.
Wow. You know?
In the desert, in the back of all these, everyone piled into these like little utes, little trucks.
So was a bus from there to India? Or had you had enough buses by that stage?
No, we continued on. Just trying to think of the names of the cities. But we entered India through Amritsar, where the Golden Temple is there. And that was beautiful. And then stayed in Delhi. Carmel got a job working in a rich person's house as a nanny or cleaner or something, and we hung around there for a couple of weeks. And then we went up to Srinagar on Dal Lake, which was beautiful, beautiful scenery, beautiful countryside, and then got sick and then came home.
Was it a serious sickness?
No, I think it was what they call jadia. It's one of those stomach things where you just can't keep anything down.
Yeah,
constantly need the toilet, you know.
So you must have been very pleased to actually step foot back in Australia at that point.
Oh, yes. But I did come into Australia with my backpack, very skinny, and customs wanted to go through my backpack, and they did, and there was nothing in it. But then they strip-searched me.
Oh, good Lord.
And I thought, well, that was the most ignoble return to my homeland because I felt like I wanted to get off the plane and just kiss the ground.
Yes.
But instead I had to stand there in front of these two female customs officers. That was pretty horrible.
Yeah, it was. That wasn't a nice return.
No.
Who met you at the airport? Your parents who didn't want you?
No. I can't remember who met me at the airport. I think I took a... I don't know.
But you must have had to go home to your parents because you wouldn't have had a
base. I went home.
Did you stay there long or was that out as quickly as possible?
I only stayed there a few weeks because I'd left a big group of friends. We'd all travelled at that time.
Right.
So when I got back, it didn't take me long to reconnect with all those friends and then move into a shared house.
Right.
And then not much later met my husband, Peter. The next part of my life began.
The next part indeed, a very big part of your life. So how did you meet Peter?
Well, I was living out in, what was it called? Just outside, Hume Vale. It's just outside Whittlesea, the base of the mountains up to King Lake, with all my girlfriends that I'd known for a long time. And we'd heard about this bloke that lived down the road that people started saying, oh, you should make sure you meet Peter, you know. And he heard about a group of women living in a house down the road. So one night he came round with a friend of his, just walked in. I hesitate to say that I fell in love on the spot, but I did look at him, and in that instant I knew that would be the man I would marry. That was a very strange, unusual
moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how long did the relationship go for before you actually formalised it by getting married? Was that a long time or a short time?
Our first child was 6 months old before we got married.
Right.
Yeah.
And Peter was working, doing what?
He was working up on a potato farm in King Lake.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that's hard slog.
Harvesting spuds and right. digging the ground and stuff. Yeah.
And so you became a full-time mother, or were you working as well?
I went back to emergency teaching for a while I was pregnant. And then once I'd had David, I didn't teach. And then we had a second child, Oliver, and then found this property here where we live in Chum Creek. And when the boys were about, I forget now, Ollie must have been 2, so David must have been 4. I went back to teaching, and Peter was the house husband and the carer. So he did all the kids through kindergarten and primary school, and he joined the mother's club and all that sort of thing. And I worked.
That was a very progressive, at that stage of our development as a nation, that was a very progressive thing for him to be doing, because these days it's almost a given, but not then.
Yeah, well, I guess we thought I had the better chance of having the qualification and could get back to teaching. Mm. And he'd worked as a laboratory technician, but there wasn't much that he could do that around here. And he loved, and we were building this house, a mud brick house, so, you know, there was a lot for him to take on.
Sure.
We were living in the little shed down the bottom there.
Yes, I have to say for people listening, when I drove into Kath's property, there's a very, quite a small mud brick house would almost be an exaggeration. a hut. But at that stage, that was all you had.
We lived in there for 2 years while we built the house.
Right. Yeah. That would have been a challenge.
It was very challenging, and I did lose it on a couple of occasions.
Totally understandable, indeed. Yeah. Because, again, for people listening, whilst where we are has running water and power and everything else, it's still fairly rural, isn't it?
Oh. I mean, we didn't have power. We had a generator.
At that stage, right.
There's no sewerage, so we had dig
your own hole.
Yes, dig your own hole. So
right.
We had to empty that every so often.
Yes.
And the house was built with either the generator or hand tools. And power didn't come up here until we'd been living in the house for a couple of years.
That must have been quite a magic moment for you to actually have power.
Loved it so much.
Things we take for granted.
Yeah.
And until you don't have them, you don't realise how important they are.
We had a kerosene fridge.
Oh, my goodness.
And a wood-fired stove and heating, and the generator would go on at night so that we could watch telly and have the lights on. But if you wanted to iron during the day and put the toaster on, you couldn't do both. You can only do one.
Mind you, we tend to forget that the generations before us, that was their lifestyle, wasn't it? Kerosene lamps and wood fires and things. So it can be done, and it is done.
Yes,
and you did it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You talk about how the house was built. It was obviously built with a lot of love too, because it's beautifully constructed.
Well, thank you. But it was basically just necessity, you know. We found out about a scheme called the Homesteaders Scheme, and the government would give you some money to buy the property, and you then had 5 years to build the house but you couldn't sell it for 10 years.
Right.
So we found this land and went for that, and then we didn't get it. So we'd already committed to buying the land. So we borrowed from my mum and dad. And then we just, you know, thought, well, mud brick's cheap.
Yes.
And if you just start from the ground and build up and put a roof on top. So we built a load-bearing house, so we didn't have to have many support beams and things like that. And we scavenged stuff from everywhere. The lintels above the windows are bridge timbers.
Right.
The glass in the windows was from Fitzroy when they built the new Woolworths or Coles down there. All the shops were torn down and we drove down there.
So these are the old shop windows.
And well, they're now double glazed.
But when you
could still see SSA etched into it from someone had written sale on it in white paint and it scratched it a bit. So, yeah, we... You know,
that must have been a learning experience because neither of you really had building in your background.
Well, Peter had. He'd built a house before with his friend.
Oh, that was a good start.
Two houses. So he's very good with tools and the like.
That's obvious, yes.
But for me, it was a very disempowering experience because I was constantly in a learning stage. Mm. So it was no, don't have the hammer like this, no nail there.
Oh,
and
goodness.
I would lose it sometimes
just
through feeling completely disempowered because I wanted to know but I didn't know. And my husband was constantly picking up my errors and mistakes and telling me how to do it. So I'd become furious. Don't you tell me what I know, but you're doing it wrong. Was quite fraught those couple of years with the kids as little kids living in.
Well, that's the other thing too.
The shed.
Yes, you've got almost like babies.
Yeah.
There. Yeah. So that's an additional pressure and stress on you.
It was.
Yeah.
Listen to older voices. The magic of memories. I'm Rob Greaves, and I'm talking with Kath Holton, and Kath is recollecting the early years with her husband, Petter.
So as the children grow up and the house is built, do you go back to work? Or do you stay at work, rather?
No, I stumbled across some people over the road and met a woman and her partner, and he said the school he taught at was looking for a teacher, and I thought, oh, I can do that. And he said, well, you need to be pretty tough. It's a hard school. It's a secondary school for kids who have failed and who are at-risk kids. So I went for the job, and in the interview they said, you need fibre. That's your key characteristics you need down here. And I said, I'm pretty resilient, you know. And so I worked for 10 years at a school called Berengarra, which was a small private school for kids with learning disabilities, behavioural issues, you know, welfare issues. And I absolutely loved it.
I can see that in your face, yes.
It was great. We did rock climbing, canoeing, bushwalking. You only had 10 kids per classroom. And the whole school was built around raising self-esteem, teaching resilience, and writing the errors of their ways.
Very rewarding.
It was. It was
because
challenging.
Because you see changes, don't
hard.
You?
We loved it. We loved it.
Yeah.
We never smiled before Easter. You never smile with the kids before Easter. You were tough and hard. But after that, you could relax. And by the end of the year, they'd be hugging you and crying. And we loved it.
Yes, that's obvious. So what brought that to an end?
The funding ran out.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, and the school was down in Glen Waverley, and I cried all the way home from Glen Waverley to Chump Creek.
Wow.
And I got picked up by the cops who breathalysed me on the way home.
Just to add to the inhumanity of the whole
sobbing.
Thing. Oh, dear.
He said, well, I hope you're all right, love.
Well, stop sticking that in my mouth.
Blokey.
Did they ask you what was wrong?
Yeah, I said I just got sacked.
Oh, well, that was not a nice day.
No. But it was tough going at that school. After 10 years, I'd had enough.
Yeah, because you've got to give so much.
I wanted to stay on, really, because
it
did make you hard and cynical and
so how
it
did
took
you,
a lot out of you, you know.
Well,
it'd
have to, I was going to say, because you're dealing with such individual stresses and group stress at the same time. So, yeah, it wouldn't have been easy. And a lot of resistance too at times, I guess, from the kids because of their...
Absolutely.
The history.
Physical resistance and abuse and verbal abuse used to cop a lot of. Just used to, you know, we used to wear our rubber suits because shit wouldn't stick to that.
Oh, God. Well, that tells a story too, yes, yes.
That was the talk in the staff room. That was never how we spoke to the kids.
Of course not. Of course not.
Yeah.
So how did you make the transition from working with quite young people to working with older people?
I got a job after that at Holmes Glen TAFE and worked in a pre-employment training program with young people to prepare them for work. And they are often kids with learning disabilities, but not so much the behavioural issues. Mm-hmm. A few kids with Asperger's, that was on the rise, or identifying it then. And then I met a bloke in the main street in Healesville who said, oh, we're going to have this fantastic weekend where we're going to be inspired by this guy to get involved in the community. And so I went along for a two-day workshop over in Steeles Creek. I met a guy called Peter Kenyon who talked about community building, about building community with just the people in it, not relying on government, not relying on the council. He said, you know, the government is not the cavalry. They are not going to appear over the hill and come riding in to save you. So your community has to get together. So we formed a group called the Yarra Valley Host, and we got funding through regional development. And I left teaching and worked in that job for 2 years. And that was at Swinburne TAFE in Healesville. And so when I was in that building, I just met a whole lot of people. That was a hub. And the Melba program was based in that building. And it was run by a woman called Hannah Skye. And I was in the office next door. So we used to just meet and talk and exchange stories. And she'd tell me about Melba and I'd talk about all my stuff. And she was local and she had a lot of knowledge. And then Hannah left and another woman came in to Melba. And then before she left, she came and spoke to me one day and said, would I like to take it over? So I went and had an interview and I moved into Melba.
It was quite a change in direction though, wasn't it?
It was.
Was it one that you, in retrospect, pleased you took?
Yes.
Yeah. What was it about the job then that gave you satisfaction?
Well, I felt like I'd started out teaching in primary school, moved to secondary, then into tertiary, and now I was working with elderly people. So I felt like I'd seen the whole spectrum of life. And I found older people are so much easier to work with. The first elderly man I visited up in Mount Evelyn, I walked into his lounge room and he said to me, oh, you're an angel and God forgot to give you wings. And I thought, that's much better than being told where to go.
And having to wear the rubber, suit.
I thought, oh, I can hear that again.
Right, right.
So I just fell in love with elderly people. I loved it, really loved it. And it was a lovely job to do.
Yeah. You were in it for quite a few years, weren't you?
10 years.
Yeah. So, the 10 years you spent in the school with the kids was very rewarding because of the challenges there. Was the 10 years as challenging and rewarding with the older people?
Oh, just in a different way. I felt like a lot, very much like your work here with Listen to Older Voices, I was privy to so many stories. And people, when you're not a part of their family or you don't know their history, I found they will open up and tell you things that they have never brought up with their family. Or they'll tell you about the issue that they've got with their child or their son or daughter, and you're the only one they can share it with, you know? And I just felt I became a custodian of so many stories, so many people's lives that were just fascinating and wonderful and heartfelt, you know? I've loved it, really loved it.
Having had that first-hand experience, as well as being with working with older people, as well as being a student of life, which obviously you are in terms of the amount of travel you've done, as you said, the spectrum of work you've done from one end of the age group to the other, looking at older people, do you think we as a community value them as much as we should?
No, definitely not.
Why do you think that is?
I think elderly people have been stigmatised. And just, I think it's changing now. I think as the baby boomers are becoming older, they're not putting up with that shit anymore.
No, they're not.
You know?
No.
And I just think we grew up in an era where elderly people were old and grey-haired and needed to be cared for. And I still feel that. But I think we've never really appreciated their wisdom, the knowledge that they've gained through life. But the other thing I've learned is that old people are just people. They're not special because they're elderly. They're just special because they're people. Because you can meet some elderly people who are not very nice, and they've been the same person throughout their whole life. So just because they're old, I do give them some sort of credence because they've made it to age, you know, they're still going. Mm. But some of the values and some of the ideas people bring with them on the way, I'm equally as horrified by as by any one that might be, you know, voting for Donald Trump. No, but there's a diversity to life, and sure. I love that, you sure. know. But
talking about life, our time is almost up, and what I'd like to just explore in the few minutes we've got left is you and your life, because unless there's an unfortunate accident like the bus down the road hits you one day, you've still got quite a few years left to live. You are in a form of retirement. What do you see yourself doing in the years to come?
Oh, I don't know. But I feel like I'm now obligated to do the things that I always said I would do but never had the time for.
Such as?
Basically around art.
Oh, okay.
Drawing, art, writing. I love photography. I'm a great one for taking photos. I've got thousands of photos. What the hell am I going to do with them all? So I've got to do something with that. I can read now. I've read more books in the last 6 months than I've read in the last 6 years. I love that. I've joined a book group.
Right.
I've joined 2 art classes. So I'm just...
So life is not slow or dull.
No, we've just come back from 2 weeks in Adelaide where we went to the Barossa Valley and McLaren Vale and stocked up on enough wine that should last for a little while.
Get you through winter at least.
And we've just come back. We had our first grandchild in England.
Well, that must have been quite an exciting moment for you. Another generation.
Yeah. So we went over there when the little baby Ray was born, and we had 6 months in England. And
talking about the generation that is just coming now, like your grandchild, and the generations to come, when you look around you at what's happening both in Australia and around the world with the environment, with the political machinations and things like this, do you have concerns for the generations to come?
Yes and no. I have concerns for the older generation who are in charge, but I think young people are dynamic, are caring. You know, I don't adhere to this, oh, young kids are always just on their phone and they're going to get spurs develop on the back of their neck from looking down so much. And, you know, the young people that I see or interact with are intelligent. They're very well educated. They know what's going on in the world. And I look around at some of the young people that, you know, that Swedish girl, I forget her name now, but she's leading the environmental movement, you know, the little schoolgirl that wouldn't go to school.
Oh, yes, yes.
Greta, I think her name is. Greta Thunberg, I think. You know, and there's young people out there doing stuff. And I think every generation has had those that just follow the norm and those that step up and beyond, and they are creative and they're making music. And then I've got one of David's friends in Scotland has just started a film company, and another one he went to school with in Healesville is a graphic designer putting murals up all over Healesville and Melbourne, and, you know, doing great things, creative, thoughtful, engaged, funny. My nieces are all empowered young women out there doing stuff, you know.
So you think the future's in good hands?
Yeah, as much as, you know, we don't want to get into a political debate about where power lies, because power is pretty entrenched in the oligarchy. So until that changes, I do think there needs to be massive political change so that we can save the environment, so that we can save the planet. But I don't have a hopelessness about the future. I certainly worry about some of the politics. But in my own life, when I look around me, I'm pretty impressed by what I see in my personal life.
Given you've still got some years to go in your life, has it up to now been a good life?
Yes, definitely. I think so.
Is it an impossible question to finish up with by saying to you, if you look back at your life, what are the things you probably value most out of that life that you've lived? What has given you most joy, pleasure?
Oh,
what is it that you...
I would have to say having a grandchild has given me more pleasure and joy than I would have ever imagined. I can't believe just looking at his photo makes me so happy. And I get little videos sent of him almost about to crawl, and I just will look at it over and over again and just laugh and smile. That's fantastic. And I've been involved in community stuff around Healesville and made some little impacts and changes, because my father would always say, you know, you've got to leave the world a better place than what you found it. You've got to leave something. So I feel like I've done that, working with difficult children, and I feel like I've supported elderly people and helped them write books. And
that's probably a very good place for us to finish, Kath. I think that that's a nice little bit of philosophy there. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Listen to Older Voices is produced by Rob Greaves at the Melbourne Community Support Program on behalf of Wesley Mission Victoria. The program is supported by financial assistance from the Commonwealth Government through the Commonwealth Home Support Program and is brought to you through the Toorak Times.